So hi, I'm Eric Stryker. I'm at SMU. Since there's only two of you, it'll be more intimate than expected. And I have, well, Bacon's one of my prime artists for the book I'm working on. So I thought we'd, oh yes, sorry, I'll try to speak up. And I thought we could focus on the Bacon for a while. One of the things that interests me about Bacon is, on one hand, the rhetoric historically that's wrapped around his work by critics like David Sylvester, Bacon himself, in which he said that his process is primarily spontaneous, right? That there's no sort of pre-planning, there's no preliminary sketches in his work. And this was said at the very same time that those fellows at the other side of the room, the American Abstract Expressionists, were experimenting with gestural painting, right? Pollock throwing paint on the canvas, on the flooring, it's a bit inelegant. Dripping, swirling, moving paint spontaneously on a canvas on the floor. So it seems that in the 50s and 60s, which is, this work is from 1956, Bacon was putting himself out there as if he was part of this trend of the unpremeditated in mid-20th century art.
Do you think he said that after the fact, or that he actually planned to do it that way? How can you create something without at least having given it some thought? You may not have written anything down.
Yeah.
I know for myself, I create things in my head before I do them or even put them on paper.
Yes.
Maybe you started out, because I wasn't here, saying, save all your questions to me.
Oh, no. Please, if it were a group of 30, maybe, but a group of two, I think we could just have a conversation. But yeah, I think you're right. I mean, is it really possible to have no premeditation, right? Nothing going on, and to act purely spontaneously? I mean, this was an idea that came out of surrealism in the 30s.
I could understand, but he had an idea of what he was going to do, how he was going to do it. He didn't know what he was going to get. Something like this is harder for me to...
Yeah. It's a structured composition, seemingly, right? I mean, it's basic,
well,
it's dark.
The point that he didn't sketch it out first, that he just started painting?
Well, I think the point is that he said he didn't sketch it out first. and all this crops up. There's a series of interviews with David Sylvester, who was a very prominent art critic in London. Of course, Bacon was working in London for the entirety of his life with slight side trips. But this all came out in a series of six interviews with David Sylvester, the critic, over about three decades. So it's there in the way they're talking about his work. And yet, sorry, go ahead.
How many of those six conversations were in pubs?
Were in what, sorry?
Pubs.
Oh, yes. You should look at YouTube. I don't know if you've ever seen this, but there's one of these, I think it might have been with a different critic other than Sylvester, but there was a BBC, I believe, production, which was a Bacon interview, around about, I think, the early 70s, if I remember correctly, in which he's being asked about his process, he's describing the kind of, turmoil that goes into his painting process, and progressively get more and more drunk over the course of the interview on television. So I think this, too, is part of this kind of myth that's been wrapped and Bacon created around himself. And yet, when he died in 1993, 1993, suddenly all this stuff came out of his studio. I do have a photo, which is always a fun photo.
He didn't
consider it part of what he would put out in the galleries for public view. This is what his studio looked like.
Oh, I love it when we get to see the studio.
And you can see, okay, all that notion of turmoil and mess and randomness. He talked in those interviews about loving roulette and just seeing where the ball fell randomly by chance. It's there, in a way.
He's an amateur, but he wouldn't have qualified for that TV show, what is it called, where they... Hoarders.
Hoarders, yeah.
Oh, yes.
He's an amateur.
Well, he was an image hoarder.
Good start.
He was definitely an image hoarder. One of the curious anecdotes here is that, it's fantastically hilarious, isn't it?
It looks fun.
Hi, welcome. We're a small group, but... when he did die in 1993, he was one of the artists that was sort of highly, one of the few artists that was sort of highly celebrated in Britain. And he, of course, was Anglo-Irish by birth, grew up in the outskirts of Dublin. And when he died, various parties got involved and sent in a team of archaeologists to map out the entire contents of his studio on the day of his death. And then it was, and you can go see it. It's reinstalled at the Hugh Lane Gallery in Dublin.
Really?
And every single object has been cataloged.
Reinstalled, that means recreated.
Yes, recreated as this kind of transported studio. Quite curious. There's this kind of fascination with the mess of Bacon's process.
And there was art in amongst this.
Well, one of the things...
Besides what's on the walls.
Yes. There were torn paintings. There's canvases that have been ripped back off. There are stretchers, and most interestingly, there were piles and piles of photographs, reproductions of other artists' drawings. You know, famously, the numerous, I think, a total of 12 or more images of Velázquez's Pope Innocent X, which is a very big image for Bacon, and he had drawn with various things on top of them. So that myth that's being promoted in that interview, for those interviews over the course of 30 years with David Sylvester, was suddenly revealed to be exactly that, a myth. So there is all this premeditation, clearly, in his process.
He just liked the story it gave off? He just...
I think it's a great story, right?
You think he just did that?
I think... I guess to be fair to him, he probably didn't want the drawings to be seen as primary works. So that might be.
Good enough. He was worried about.
He's worried about. I think he's probably worried about. My guess is that he probably was worried about them being seen as sketches, in the sense that yes, exactly. And he wanted to have this public image at least. Critical image, art critical image of the spontaneous, the random, the roulette player, the man who loves chance and chance encounters too. Another interesting anecdote here is he gave a huge stack. This might be a little bit of an apocryphal story, it's debated, but he supposedly gave a very large stack of drawings to his neighbor and asked him to burn them, which didn't happen. It might not be a true story, but it's certainly one of the stories that's out there. And the drawings do exist.
Say what those drawings were?
We have them. They're cataloged at the Tate Museum in London. Yes.
You've been to the recreation.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Obviously, you didn't pay much for electricity with one single light bulb in the room. Are there windows behind me?
Where's
the light?
This is the photograph of the South Kensington studio where it was located. In the Hugh Lane reinstallation, recreation of this gallery, you're actually looking into it through windows. So I don't know how they would line up with the actual original South Kensington windows. But he did say that he'd like to have some light in his studios.
There's light for this, but you don't know whether it was electric or windows or this was a basement or what.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Yeah.
It's interesting, too, that they are reopening Dal Judd's house in New York City, and everything is exactly the way he left it.
Yes. It's interesting to see which artists get this treatment. And of course, in Britain and Ireland, there's a number of artists who have, ties to Scotland or Ireland or Wales, who then become sort of iconic figures, heroized in those nations within the UK. Palazzi is another one, an independent group artist who is now has his studio recreated in the Modern Art Museum in Edinburgh. So there's definitely this trend.
It's kind of like a pantomime of we got to see on a painting. So they're just having the whole gallery, having the whole forest.
Yeah, yes. It's a bit, I think it's fair to use the word fetishistic, isn't it? This is kind of, you know,
well,
obsession with everything.
That with the barn.
Yeah. And they did it with the floor of Bacon, sorry, the floor of Pollock's studio. Interesting. I don't know where it is now, but it might still be on Long Island. I'm not sure about that. Yeah. You had a thought?
Well, I had another question.
Yes.
I see no specific evidence to point in that direction other than I can say he's not obsessive compulsively neat. But was he an alcoholic?
Well, yes. This is also something that's... There's three biographers of Bacon, and this is... When you read the biographies, they're very... Well, they love these little details about how often Bacon got drunk, how often sort of famously got into a brawl, an argument with Giacometti in the Cave de France, which is a pub was a pub in Soho in London. And the story is that he, in the middle of this argument about philosophy, he picked up the table and threw the drinks at Giacometti. So there's these stories of this kind of behavior there. I personally find them a bit dubious. There might be some root in truth, but you know, biographers do have to spin a narrative. We like to read those biographies, but I would, you know, my personal attitude is that I'm a bit cautious about taking them as fact. So, let's see. I also have I'm gonna have to collect these. I also have I want to focus on some of the things in Bacon that are structured, right, that do seem to have patterns, that do have a sense of organization, which may not be totally pre-planned, but still that sense of organization is there. One of the terms that Sylvester came up with in describing with Bacon, Bacon's paintings, is the space frame, hyphenated space frame. And what they meant are, it's very faint in this image, in this painting, but what they meant are these in very light lines. You can see there's a sort of in the background and underneath these structural elements which seem to be very basically tied to perspectival drawing, right? The way that one creates a sense of depth traditionally. That is something that occurs again and again and again in Bacon's work. And what's interesting about this one and many others is they're not one space frame, but there's several, right? So we have this individual structure, faint white lines, partly painted over in black. We have this element here as well. And note how they actually sort of work through each other. It's quite faint in this one. But very often, particularly in the mid-50s, at one point, one space frame sort of pops out in front of the other. So there's this toying with what is where in the work. Now, what Bacon said is that he used the space frame as a way of situating the figure. Okay, there it is, situated within this very basically rendered space, which seems to be almost three-dimensional, but not quite. And yet, there also is a kind of seeming struggle to situate the figure. Note, the foot and the shoe here is echoed in a line that he's painted out. There's this kind of sketchy quality to it. The same thing happens in the coattails, and so on. I'm going to show you, I have lots of images. I want to show you, this is one of his drawings from the studio, note the rip. And pass it around. Clearly, and there's many examples of these, it shows that, indeed, one of the things, certainly, Bacon was premeditating, planning, was the space frame itself. Perhaps it was one of the most important elements. Here's one of the paintings that ties to. I'll pass this around. So this is from 1952, 4 years before this self-portrait from 56. And you can see the space frame is identical to the drawing, which has been ripped somehow, probably under his foot. So,
I won't have to put it on the floor, man. Oh, yeah.
So I think one of the questions that fascinates me about this is, what is this space frame? What is it about? What is its purpose? Is it possible, and I do think it is possible, to see it as something more than simply situating the figure within the picture plane, as he said its main function was. So I would like to, and I do suggest, that we consider the space frame as a kind of basic element which indirectly references and calls to mind sort of visual culture of the changing spaces of London in the post-war period. This was, of course, after the Blitz. There was lots of building, lots of rebuilding of certain spaces. There were bomb sites that were being used as cafes. Interesting anecdote. Even in Soho, where Bacon spent his evenings, many evenings, drunk, and so forth. So I think that alone is very suggestive. Now, what do we make of, for instance, the fact that this is one of many mid-50s paintings with this incredibly dark palette in which the space frame is there? This one, you might sort of read it as a bed that he's sitting on. And this is certainly a very common theme in all of Bacon's work for his entire career. The bed is a kind of significant element, right? Something like, but not quite, a headboard and this sort of element here. But this is 2 years after a series of works he did called Man in Blue. I have more images. And you can see these are not great photographs. They don't have quite this brown tone to them in person. But you can see just how similar this is to the Man in Blue series. Here's one. This is, by the way, not self-portrait, or he doesn't say it is anyway. Here's another. The palette's the same, the structure is the same. You could say the whole sort of compositional ethos of the work is incredibly similar. So 56, that series of 54. If you see what I mean. So what is that about? I'm tempted to, and I think it's worth entertaining, discussing the possibility that this may, in fact, not be a representation of the spaces that Bacon lived in, socialized in, got drunk in, whatever, but at least tied to a whole range of possible social spaces that were part of the sort of new London during Reconstruction after the Blitz. So here's one possibility. It's a pub, right? Dark, black, smoky, not transparent, or perhaps like a photograph of a pub. One of his friends, Daniel Farson, bar. Daniel Farson's photographs, many these Bacon knew, looked at, had collected, a very close friend of his, photographing the scene of this particular sort of bohemian network of socializing spaces in London. And it shows at least the possibility that these don't represent those spaces, but call to mind the way in which there are, in fact, these sort of new tentative, shifting, and temporary, ultimately, social spaces in this new kind of bohemian scene that Soho was. The most famous example of this new sort of bohemian scene in Soho was the Colony. There was the Cave de France, which was also quite important. It was upstairs. He had a brawl with Giacometti. The Colony, around the corner on Dean Street, was a hangout for Lucian Freud, Francis Bacon. Hockney went there. This whole range of, well, the artists that we know as representing mid-20th century British art. And again, the biographers talk a hell of a lot about what happened at the Colony. Muriel Belcher was the barmaid, I guess she would have been called then, who was reported to be crass and shouting across the bar. Everyone knew each other. Apparently Bacon would sort of police the door and say, well, you're not a good artist, you can't come in, and so forth. So there's this definition, right? A kind of definition of a particular social milieu, right, social group. That quality, I think, is very, I think, potentially important in his work. It suggests the possibility that these figures, now here is a self-portrait of Bacon, it looks so much like these other figures who are in fact tied to everyone else. He's basically indirect representation of his cohorts. It suggests that these paintings are part of a kind of, if you will, a kind of social family, or maybe a better word would be a kind of a subculture, right? A network of individuals who belong together. So what does that suggest about the space frame, right? Tentative, shifting, it can refer to many places indirectly. It is a bed at one moment, a bar at another. It suggests that this kind of multiplicity may in fact be describing, referring to the, well, this temporary and shifting new social environment. And it's of course one of many in post-war London. It wasn't just bohemians that were emerging as a kind of new subculture. The entire city was, its cultural geography was shifting. Fundamentally, in many ways, the end of empire, famously, brought about, there was a need for labor to rebuild Britain, which meant that there was lots of migration from the colonies becoming new nations at the time. That meant that areas that were historically working class English, right, and areas that were bombed out significantly were being, the demographics of those areas were themselves shifting, right, changing, altering. So this kind of fracture, the multiplicity of the space frame, and even when we look at how the face, which is tentatively Bacon himself, is broken. The nose is out of place, the eye is shifted up, the hair itself seems to be pulled into the dark background. These qualities seem to suggest this sort of tentative relationship to this fractured, shifting, larger cultural and subcultural scene of post-war London. So let's do a few more comparisons. How many of you know Bacon's work and seen others? I know you have. Okay. So you may have noticed a tendency to have represented elements that are similar to curtains and tassels on curtains. Sometimes walls and windows crop up, right? So there's a sense of the room that is there. I'll show one to you, or maybe two, actually. This is from 1950, roundabout, Man at Curtain. Again, I'm sorry, apologize for the brown, it's my poor photographic skills. It's much more black. And you can see within it, anybody see it? There's two space frames. And within the back one, this figure is pulling on a tassel and framed by this element. And it is, in fact, called Man at a Curtain. So what might this, where is this coming from? Well, we know that there is a very large quantity of photographs, wartime cartoons by a particular cartoonist named David Lowe, which have this device in it, curtains being pulled down. I would like to suggest, and I think there's a good argument to be made, that in fact the curtains refer to the blackout during the Blitz. This national enforcement, there was even social community policing of the need to black out your homes at night, pull the windows, pull the shades down, right, to make it impossible for the planes overhead to know where you are, right, to find a kind of target for a bombing in a blitzkrieg. That, I think, is an interesting possibility. And given that in the 50s, at least, this dark, black environment that is, again, in this one and many others, seems to be tentatively and indirectly charged, right, with this sense of the memory of the blackout. So there's two things that Bacon talked about when remembering the blackouts and discussing the blackouts. He discussed on one hand the way in which it was a sort of defining moment in the national culture of Britain. The entire nation was told to do this, did do this. They were, if you didn't do it correctly, you were told to do it properly. There's a sense of tidiness in making things dark. I think that sense of the importance of the blackout and the memory of the Blitz, it's interesting that Bacon would put it there. The blackout as tied to national culture and national identity. The other thing he said about the blackouts was that, well, while all of those people were going off and sealing up their homes and socializing with their family inside there, make sure that they're protected and sealed up, there was also all these new social opportunities that it created outside the home. Bacon and many others, of course, would go out into the city and find, people to have encounters with, and there would be we call it drinking and find new friends. There was a sense of this kind of opportunity for subcultural behaviors and subcultural connections outside the home at the very same moment that national culture is being defined by blacking out all the homes of Britain. So that kind of duality is, I think, an interesting one in his work. It suggests that, yes, there might, in fact, be a sense in which the space frame refers both to what sociologists call dominant culture, national culture, enforced culture, national morals and mores, while also simultaneously being tied to the subcultural, right? The subordinate, the abject, even. And I think that when one looks at that thing that everybody noticed about Bacon, which is that sense of the monstrosity, right? The torn face, the teeth that gnash, the mouth that is a kind of image of horror, which is again crops up in so many Bacon works. I think it might, in fact, be a mistake to see it simply as an image of horror. Could it not be, right, this sense of being pulled in two directions, right, into the home, into the national culture, into the kind of enforced national mores of things like the blackout, and in the other direction, right, into this kind of external world of new subcultural possibilities? Yeah.
Yeah. And not knowing any of the history or background, subsequent to the war, many people were disfigured.
Yes. Great. Yeah, and in fact, Daniel Farson in his Photographs of the Pubs, which I think is out there somewhere still, he photographed many veterans who had amputated limbs. Oh, thank you. They're not very important. amputated limbs and, yeah, replaced eyes. Yeah. That sense of the disfigured body as a social reality and not just the monstrous, right? I think is, and that's an interesting and I think very important point. Of course, many people still do talk about the kind of horror of Bacon's images. I think it's fair to say that the horror, or what is perceived to be horror, is nothing more than a social fact, right? That social fact, but also many others, right? Violence is there in the world just at the same time as beauty is, as Bacon said. Go ahead.
So you don't think it's an artifice to get us to look at the painting and the subject because we are attracted to grotesqueness?
Yeah. We objectify it, right? We treat grotesqueness as an object.
Because it's different than normal than what we're used to, and we don't like the stare, but it's okay to stare at a painting. It draws us in.
Yeah, you could critique Bacon on that level, certainly. You say that he's in fact participating in this. That's great. Yes, voyeurs. I think that element of voyeurism is actually another strain in Bacon's work, which I'm glad you brought that up. One of the things that people very often miss, because in context of museum, it seems to make sense for conservation reasons. Note that this is glazed, meaning has glass over it. Notice that this painting is glazed, which means it has glass over it. It is conservation, but it's not a conservator's decision to do that. Bacon glazed all his paintings. So not only do you have the space frames within the work defining the space liminally, which was situated the quote monstrous figure, but It is a sealed space itself, which we are, you're right, peering into almost voyeuristically. I think that, yeah, it's, I think in some ways it's a challenge, it's a provocation.
A reflection in it then?
Yes, the reflections. That the
to be reflected in the body.
Yeah, I think that's great. We see ourselves in the image, right? It's actually very often very uncomfortable. I went to look at a work in the National Gallery of Canada by Bacon, a work from 1958. It was another one of these dark Bacons from the 50s. And it was lit in a way that made it impossible to see the entire image at once. So you would always get this, as you do here to a slightly less extent, you'd always get this reflection of the light and reflection of yourself interfering in your ability to see the image, right? So, yeah, I think that is a provocation on that level, right? To be a voyeur and then to be aware that you're a voyeur, right? To kind of possibly objectify the quote-unquote monster, but then also to realize that this, in fact, might be a kind of social fact, a reality, just the way things are, right? Yeah, yeah.
I was so shocked when it arrived in this beautiful frame.
Yeah. The frames, yes. He very often, I don't know about, I mean, I should talk to the conservator, I don't know about this particular frame, but he very often did choose his frames. And he did like these shiny ones, which are actually a bit antiquated by the 50s, right? With everybody over in New York not even using frames. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so that sense of the bounded is enhanced there as well. In this particular one, it even has, I believe, yes, this sort of wood inset, right? So that's, it can doubled over, multiplied. So let's see, what else do I have? Well, I think one thing we could think about a little bit is this notion of the figure as a kind of fractured entity. How long are we in time?
1:37.
Oh, wow.
How much time?
How did that happen? Well, I'll just keep going. One of the things that he said about, I don't know if you know this work, it's at the MoMA, if anybody's been there and spent time with it. It's called Painting 1946, not the most exciting title, but it's one of the most important Bacons, not just because it's at the MoMA and very often talked about, but his rhetoric about it is interesting. Now, this is what it looks like. I can pass this around again. You can see that there's a lot going on in it. There's a figure at the center. There's a cow carcass that's been split up in the background. There's a room with curtains, again, and tassels, that's been inverted at the background. And then there's this entity at the front, this kind of contradicting sort of stage, steel device there at the front, which contradicts the kind of spaces that are otherwise represented there. What he said about this work, he was talking about his process. He said that he started it by trying to paint a bird alighting in a field. Now, where is that, right? you'll have a chance to see in a second. Alighting, taking off, right, in a field. It's not there, right? Or if it's there, it's under something else. Right, so the sense of starting at one place and ending up in another, right? Starting with one figure, right, a bird, and ending up with a man with an umbrella, a cow carcass, these other sort of body-like elements in the foreground. That gives a kind of multiplicity of many figures in one representation, if it is a representation, is there quite early in his work. I mean, this is a turning point work in his career. And when we go back and look at this, right, we can see how, even though it is clearly just one figure here, the hands, we're not exactly sure where one hand starts and the other begins. If they're hands at all, they seem to be this kind of knot of individual strokes of paint. The splitting of the face, which we already talked about as well. And there's one other element here. That sense of the curtain comes back. In direct relationship to this multiplied, split, torn, fractured figure. Note the lines that go down across the front. You can see I'll let you get close if you want. You can, and so here as well, in form of kind of a drip, right? Very often, especially in the 50s, he would, at a certain point towards the end of creating a painting, sort of brush, very dry brush, some black or other color paint vertically down across the surface, a kind of wipe across the image. Not unlike those curtains being pulled down. For a good comparison, I'll show you this. In this one, simply called Study for the Human Body, it is in fact a curtain, two curtains, and you can see how these vertical stripes, in fact, are not just there in front of the figure, but they're both in front and behind and through the figure, right? So the sense of the fractured body, the fractured figure, is being fractured by the space that the figure exists in, right? And is defined within. Okay, so I guess the question I want to get to is, what relationship exactly does this have to these new social groups in London in these years? There's three that I think are important. We've already talked about the Bohemian a little bit. Bohemian, what is the Bohemian, right? Well, kind of know at least provisionally what that is. Somebody who sort of lives like an artist and sort of goes off in the world and is creative. And sociologists, I think very rightly, very often talk about how the Bohemian is somebody who separates him or herself from their middle class origin and then goes into some sort of other social group. So it's a deviation from one's middle class standard and existence and background. If you look at so-called Bohemian scenes in New York or in London or Paris or elsewhere in the 19th and 20th century, that's pretty much true. This is generally what a lot of our avant-garde artists were. Interestingly, the sense of dislocation, right, that the Bohemian exists in shows up pretty directly in a series of works from 1957, so 1 year after this, that are based on famous Van Gogh painting On the Road to Arles, which many of you might know, in which this is painted at a time when Van Gogh himself was going off to Arles, traveling to this new place in Europe where he would paint with others. Famously, the others didn't arrive, and then or arrived and quickly left, Gauguin, for instance. This is what Bacon did with that image. Not very pretty, is it? I'll sort of show it around. I should have brought in the reproduction of the Van Gogh. You can see that the entire composition is identical, and yet the execution is, well, I think what most people would see as sloppy. There is an anecdote that the biographers attach to this. They say that he created all 7 of these paintings, all based on the Van Gogh painting On the Road to Arles, within 3 or 4 days before an exhibition, right? So there they are, going on the walls, wet. People arrive for the opening, and there's another kind of anecdote where apparently somebody backed into one, got paint on her blouse. Who knows if it's true? That's kind of narrative of Bacon as the spontaneous, messy artist doing chaotic things. Okay, maybe. What I think is most important and most interesting here is that what he actually does in what may or may not have been this rapid, rushing manner, the paint's dripping. The paint is sort of moving around the surface. It doesn't form the figures well. Even the landscape itself is this kind of messy blur and stretch of paint across the surface. It's not very interesting as a kind of beautiful image, right? Conventional sense. And yet, there in this particular one, and others as well, he does take the time to put in this space frame. Almost like a Solowitz box around the painter on the road to Arles. So here's a painting which he's creating after another painting of clearly tied to the sense of the Bohemian, right? And he puts the space frame in it. I think that this suggests, for me, a strong possibility that the space frame actually stands in for, like is a symbol of this definition of, in this case, Bohemian, right? A subcultural group.
You mean the dead things?
Yeah. Well, in the sense that he's defining, right? He's putting the space frame onto this figure, and the figure stands in for the bohemian.
Oh, the figure.
Yeah. I mean, that's what the Van Gogh would have been. Sorry I have so many images. Do you mean the paintings themselves?
Right.
All the paintings were shown. That I'm showing you, anyway. I don't think I brought in any images of the destroyed works. Generally, there's a few straps of canvas.
But there, the space frame looks out of place, whereas here in some of the other images, it does not.
Yeah.
It's
sort of plopped in. It's you could almost say that it's a very basic architectural device, right? The box as one of the structural elements that's used in modernist architecture, right? The steel grid and girder. I think you're right, out of place. And he's simply dropping it into what is essentially a Van Gogh painting that he's recreated. There does seem to be, on that level, potential link between Bacon's method, process of painting, and the bohemian. Second group, I think, is even more interesting. Bacon was quite interested in criminality and criminals. And there's a whole series of anecdotes which I could tell you. I'll just give you one. He told what is, in my mind, almost definitely an untrue story, in which he met a lover when the lover tried to break into his studio in East London. somebody sort of breaking into your home and the sort of beautiful relationship coming out of that. Right, this kind of, at least narrative interest in criminality is there in how he talks about himself, at least. And it also shows up in a lot of his work. This one's a little difficult to get to directly, so what I will do is compare it with you to this rather well-known 1953 work called Man with a Dog, a Bacon. And you can see that the man is barely there. He's a shadow in the image. They're on a curb, some sort of urban setting. And at the top, this kind of streak of black goes across it. In the late 40s and 50s in London, there was a particular slang word, which I'll introduce to you, a very interesting one. There was these characters, shall we call them, called spivs, S-P-I-V, and spiv. And the spiv was somebody who basically negotiated the black market. Criminal, right? Broke the laws on, you can't forget that in the post-war Britain, there was still rationing of pretty much everything until 1954. It's quite surprising in a way, isn't it, given what was happening in the US, prosperity and all that. So rationing was continued, and here we have this working class figure, criminal figure, of the spiv, who shows up in popular culture, in film, television. He talked about in the news during the war, which is when the word originates from. He was demonized in the mass media of Britain. After the war, in working class communities especially, you know, the down and out of London and elsewhere, he became somewhat celebrated. Because here was this nice guy who brought the things that you need that you can't quite get. There's a shift in how in working class cultural perception of this particular criminal type, what his sort of value was, so to speak. A kind of hero. Criminal hero. That's true. It's sort of is always there on some level, isn't it? This one, Man with Dog. Ah, oh, where is that one? You caught me out. I think, is it at MoMA? It's pretty well reproduced. I really should know that. Email me and I'll give you the answer. I apologize. I think it might be in the MoMA, actually. I do want to show you something to compare it to. One of those popular cultural images of the spiv, if I can find it. No, I seem to have forgotten it. I had a photograph of a spiv with these children, who was bringing the children some goodies. Right? And this very kind picture, clearly out of a magazine, which represented him that way. I think it's possible at least, when looking at paintings such as this one, again, the dark shadow figure, to see it as maybe not directly a representation of a spiv in the way that we've defined it, but at least about these kind of shadowy figures who operate within these working class, especially, environments, doing things that aren't quite seen, right, but are nonetheless happening. I think that's something worth considering, again, tying it to the sense of the palette of these works in the 1950s, the dark, the austere, light deprived, right? Character of this painting. There's another engagement with criminality in Bacon's work, which I think is even more interesting. When I was digging through the archives in Dublin from the resurrected studio, one of the things I found was a collection of articles from a French journal called Crapule. And one of the articles, that was heavily, as you can see from this image, heavily marked up and torn and has Bacon's fingerprints all over it, he's clearly been reading it, has the title, the Sociological Conception of Crime. And what are the images? Well, the images that I'll show you, I'll pass it around in a moment, they're images of a crime scene. Above the title, there's, a corpse laying on the floor next to a bed. And on the other page, there's the bed in which the crime, the murder, happened. In Bacon's notes, his notebooks from the same time period, again and again, this phrase, the bed of crime, crops up. He writes it again and again. And so here, as in so many other Bacon works, when we have something that looks at least provisionally like a bed, I think there's a possibility of connecting it back to his apparent interest in this notion of a kind of site of crime, right, where the bed stands in for this kind of things where bad things like murders happen, right? Yes. It was okay. So in 1957, the Wolfenden Report was released, which was a government. They're called white papers over there, studies effectively, which advanced the argument politically that homosexuality should be decriminalized in Britain. And in fact, it did happen in 1963. But at this point, 1956, I think there is. Not the report itself, but I do think that there is, in fact, an indirect reference, right, to the criminalization of homosexuality. This sort of coupling in, we could say the dominant culture, government, bourgeoisie, so forth, of criminality and homosexuality, right? Now we only have one figure here, so it's a little harder to get to that. Nonetheless, you may have seen this work before. Two figures, 1953. So again, same time period, same palette, the tones of colors for paint are quite similar, a little bit brighter in this work, but nonetheless quite similar to the combinations of peaches and whites and grays, which penetrate each other and sort of scratched over each other in the body. So they're very similar, and this one clearly has a bed in it. So it has the space frame, the white outline, and then it has the bed as a kind of second conflicting, which doesn't even quite fit in the room. Right. Notice, I'll show you in a minute, the headboard is way off at the side, outside the other space frame. And within it, of course, I'll pass it this way. Oh, you want all of them, yes. Oh, yes, I never passed around that one, sorry. So, I mean, this is, one could be very literal when viewing a work like that. Oh, and say, well, here is a coupling, shall we say, of two men. On the other hand, one could be less literal and, again, look at the images that Bacon was working with in his studio, fingerprints all over them, and say that, maybe it has an indirect reference to homosexual intimate coupling, but it also has references to such things as this. The Edward Muybridge Human Locomotion Studies, some very well-known studies of motion from the turn of the century. So in these, this chronophotography that Muybridge engaged in, looking at how bodies themselves move physically across time. So one photograph after another after another. So this one is actually from his studio. Again, you can see his fingerprints on it. The figures themselves are struggling. They happen to be naked, which, you know, one could obviously misread that, or maybe read it correctly as having some sort of homoerotic connotation. So these, I think that there's multiple associations again which can be tied to it. And this is one. Crime is the other. Murder is another one. And then intimacy, right, is also there. So I think that this kind of goes back to one of the things that Bacon says about violence, painting, and beauty. Some of his comments across his life are quite startling on the surface. He described many incidents in everyday life, always incidents on the street, right? Very interesting. He's describing things that happen in the street in every day that are surprising. One of them, horrifyingly, was apparently he saw somebody got hit by a car and went about describing in very basic detail the sort of violence of that scene. And he said that he used, in my mind, somewhat uncomfortable, but he used the word beauty for it, kind of seeing beauty in something that's absolutely horrific. Right? And I think that sounds terrible, right? But I think what he meant by beauty is that there's something that particularly visually and even psychologically captivating, that moment of shock and horror, right? Which sets it apart from all the other things that one sees in everyday life. The sense of, you know, you may have a sense of the beautiful on looking at a 19th century landscape painting. There's a way in which that's a different, that experience with that aesthetic experience of the painting sets it apart from the rest of your everyday life. In the same way that something as horrific as blood, right? Disfigured bodies on the streets, violence happening, even social violence happening, that sort of jumps out and gets our attention. And I think that quality, right, of the exceptional, where violence and what he called beauty are simply the facts of life, right? It is what happens in the world. I think is very much part of the larger sensibility of Bacon's paintings, right? To look at what, at his time at least, would have been uncomfortable and see both the disfigured and the appreciated, right, at the same time. So I think I might leave it there, but we do have time, I think, for questions, I hope. Yeah. I could show you some of his criminological... No. Well, no, it's been great. I could show you some of the criminological photographs that he collected, if you're interested. Stuff at Greg's. Oh, yes, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So we must have a strange interest in our...
Yeah, it's some sort of human instinct, probably.
And he called it beauty.
He did. He also described the violence of paint and the violence of reality in the same moment that he talked about the beauty of violence, right?
Do you think, is this a part of the study? This is a question. So is he maybe one of those people who would look at what Kant said about beauty and sublime, and then to call these kind of sublime things that we might see, to call them beauty, and kind of mix these together?
It sounds possibly, yeah. He never, as far as I know, he never used the word sublime, but that sort of Burkean quality of the sublime as something that overwhelms. Yeah, I think that's possible that it's there.
Yeah.
But I do think that his notion of beauty is grounded in the sort of the grit and the mess of everyday life, the mess of the street, and the mess of the cultural geography of a city which is just undiscernible at that point, right? Where will people settle? Now, I should have brought them in, but I have a whole stack of photographs, news photographs of people who are displaced in London, also other British cities, holding signs saying, "We are displaced persons, a woman at the pram." That sense of dislocation in the city, I think, is certainly an object of focus, right? At the same time as for Bacon, these sort of moments of violence in the city are kind of objects of focus as well. But yeah, as far as mixing the categories of sublime and violence, it's possible. Yeah, I just don't know if I don't know if he was really interested in that sense of being overwhelmed, right? As much as just sort of the exceptional moment of captivation, right? Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Stands out.
I want to ask you about the curtains and the veil.
Yes.
I never thought that was an element that was maybe kind of an end in of itself. I always thought it was just sort of a means to another end, the way he always pulls the paint and blurs the body.
Yes. It is that.
It means to, you know, kind of get to some of those, to try to show maybe several of those more rich photographs at once. I always thought of these hands just moving, so we're seeing them.
Yeah.
Seeing them move. But the idea that maybe it isn't several perspectives of the head at once. That's what I always kind of thought of the movie. It's that.
A sort of late cubist.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's I think motion is quite important. It's hard to do with this image, but some other works from the 1950s, he described pouring, just kind of pouring paint on the surface. The kind of liquidity and the shifting material of paint, I think, is that sense of motion in the material of paint is, I think, important for him in this period, in a way that you're describing the hands as having their own sort of, even though they're not very liquid, that sense of motion that's suggested there.
And yes to that. I mean, one of the reasons that I was really attracted to Bacon, maybe one of his most contemporaries, is that other people are, say, friends. They're pouring paint, and it's nice.
Yeah.
But he's getting that same fluidity with his dry paint.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, especially. Yeah. Yeah, it shows up. It's interesting that these, you know, where's the most fluid, where's the most thick paint being applied? It is, in fact, the dark, right? This at the back of the head, there's more paint there than at the flesh, right? I think that sense of the flesh being subsumed in some overwhelming quality of darkness, and the dark that is more liquid, is an interesting quality. And it is quite common in the mid-50s works. I don't know if I answered your question or not. But, there's a meditation. Yeah. Yes?
The back legs bothered me.
This one here? Yes. It is pulled. It is pulled, right? Yes, motion and breaking, right? That has been, it has two. This seems to be his first rendering, and he decided, no, I'm going to have it here, which also suggests what one might do with one's foot sitting at the edge of a bed, right? So again, the kind of motion. But what's interesting there is, you know, I think that we have certain moments a sense of liquidity or fluidity in the paint and material, and another moments the sense of fracture and motion, and that sense of two types of motion in one way of one process of art making is quite exceptional. I can't think of I can't think of other contemporaries of his that were doing this, although certainly Lucy and Freud picked up on it and used it in a slightly different way. Right, yes.
He was so tall.
Yeah.
And I think that's where his style was quite unique.
Mm.
You know, plus he gave paint total freedom.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't come with a preconceived idea. He would just come to the paint or come to the canvas with a very, very loose understanding of what he
did. Yeah.
And he was a very instinctual.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
He let go when his instincts told him it was finished. That was it.
Yeah. And sometimes the instincts. Yeah. And sometimes the instincts went full circle. They sort of do the painting, then tear it up and start over again, again and again. And that quality of the kind of cyclical way of working in his work, I think, is also really fascinating. I mean, it's just like those wrestling figures tumbling over each other, struggling like. To create a posture, a stable posture, and failing.
He was part of the school of the existentialists. But he was even more immediate. He was just, you know, you see his faces, they're kind of like moving.
Yeah, there's a...
He was you could call him immediate. Totally immediate. People portrayed them. The moments are such an extreme that, as he said one time, he said he wanted to get the sensation without the conveyance.
Hmm. Yeah, that's, yes.
So it just, yeah. Paint is just it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just, you can't get into it as much as they jump out.
I think those qualities are incredibly important for Bacon's work. I think they also come out more later on. After the 50s, you know, after the years of austerity, after color comes back, right? and it does, in fact, come back into his work, well, comes into his work after, well, 1960, roughly. Swinging London and all that.
There's some things I love as well. You know, the meat hanging in the butchers.
Yes, I have there, had many of those, actually, including a self-portrait. It's from the market, of course. Yeah. Smithfield's. Oh, there's an image of Mussolini that he used in one, and they did an identical one in which he is in the same position where Mussolini was. Fantastic.
I grew up in London, and it was very homogeneous, but you could go into a butcher shop and see these groups.
Yeah, and they're dying off.
And, you know, what I love about him is, I never saw that when I went into a butcher shop. That's what happened to me. And then you saw it, wow, that's a beautiful slab of meat.
Yeah.
You know, he made, as artists do, they make you see things, you know, that you normally dismiss.
Yeah.
But he made you.
I'm so glad you said that. I mean, the sense of the meat as the body as meat in Bacon, and the meat as a kind of icon. It takes the position of Christ in many of his works, flayed out with the arms going into a cruciform shape, very often in the background of some other scene. But I think you're right. Yeah, it is the butchery. It is the work of butchering that he's bringing into the painting. I do think there's.
He just as that slab of meat that made me realize, you know, when I didn't realize it, but after he painted it, it's beautiful.
Yeah. He does it well.
The kind of horror that you just turn makes you blind to things. You know, you think of horror. But then he turned into a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
By his genius.
Yeah, he described going through Smithfield's on a number of occasions and just watching the process of meat being butchered, the abattoir.
It's commonplace, you just think, it takes an artist to see that it's.
But. I also think the thing that really fascinates me about the butchered icons, let's call them. Is that at the same time that he's doing this, there's free cinema films, there's Mama Don't Allow, for instance, from 1956, same year, in which the film, documentary film, follows working class youths coming out from their individual occupations, one's a butcher, And then they go to Wood Green, into a jazz club, and they're all teddy boys and teddy girls and dancing. That sense of kind of a working class life, which is existing in two arenas, right? The Teds and, well, the work, right? Is, I think that's very much a kind of post-war...
They were scary people. That was a
lot.
So.
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, you would find them scary then. Fantastic. Do you still have the clothes?
Sorry?
Do you still have the clothes for Dream Mod?
You know, I threw them all night in the 70s. Now
yes, they are back. Yeah, it's a bit more artificial now, though. Yeah. Great. We ran way over time, didn't we?